This is part 11 of The Horse and the Rider. It's one story that begins at part 1, so if you haven't heard that, go back. And the Rider, part 11, The Break. At the redhead's instruction, the man in the black suit stood up and stretched and shuffled up the aisle towards the train toilet. Jackie looked down hard at her hands and tried to project the air of someone minding their own business. She felt an oddly cool sensation on her face and looked up. The redheaded man was blowing air at her. When she looked at him, he smiled.
How are you acclimatizing to all this? Enough room there? What's his deal?
He pointed at Peter and winked theatrically.
Did you kill someone?
He asked in a stage whisper.
Couple of people? One or two? I've killed people. I hate it.
He shrugged and did a silly voice.
Oh, but they came for my big bag of money.
Oh,
he continued.
I spilled the beans again.
Jackie stared at him with rising irritation.
But I'll tell you what,
he said, wagging a finger at her.
I'd be surprised if you even tried to steal my money. Most people don't have the wherewithal to try for a difficult take, even if the reward is worth it. What could you do with all this money? Start over? Start new?
He was suddenly serious again.
You need money to outrun a murder warrant.
He sat back down in his seat, and after a few seconds, Jackie heard zipping and the scrape of something rough. It was a rhythmic scraping that was familiar to her, though she couldn't immediately remember how or why. A sound she'd heard many times before, in situations benign enough to be forgotten. And still there was a sinister association to the sound, and she mustered up her courage and raised her head. She swallowed a scream. In front of her, less than a metre away, the red-headed man was leaning over the back of his seat towards her, one end of a long grey strap in his hand. The other end was knotted around his neck. It was the kind of strap made of abrasive material to sharpen knives on, and he pulled the end in his hand to keep it taut and slid a thin and finely pointed knife up and down it. As he pulled it, his entire head turned dark red. The veins in his neck bulged as he strangled himself, but even as he did so, his hand maintained an even and steady stroke up and down the strap. She stared at him in mute horror. After maybe 40 seconds, he slithered quickly backwards into his seat. Jackie heard a soft giggle. The black-suited man returned from the bathroom. He placed one of the small train pillows against the window and nodded off. The red-headed man stretched his legs out on the seat opposite. They were silent again. The carriage slept, with the exception of Jackie, who sat bolt upright. The sudden and acute awareness that metres away from her was the solution to not just Leanne's financial problems, but to her own need to cover costs in a new life, was electrifying. At 5 a.m, the intercom dinged softly and the conductor said,
"Ladies and gentlemen, we'll shortly pass Albury. Please lower your window shades."
Jackie reached into her small backpack and retrieved her toothbrush, toothpaste, and a small spray can of deodorant. She dug her fingernails hard into Peter's leg. He flinched and let out a small moan.
"Wake up, Peter," she hissed. "Wake up, it's time."
She rose from her seat and leaned slightly over the seat in front. The red-headed man appeared to be asleep, and in his lap was the blue sports bag. It had soft handles and a slight swell at the bottom as though it held something heavy and flat. Jackie stepped over Peter's legs and turned right. The carriage led on to another vestibule with two bathrooms, and she pushed the button on the automatic door to enter it. The door hissed open. The vestibule floor was a solid functional grey, set out of a material that gripped passengers' shoes so they didn't fall as the train moved, but on the floor of the bathroom was a quaint and beautiful marble tile of large white squares and smaller inset grey diamonds with black grout. It was out of place, and Jackie stared at it for a moment before she stepped into the bathroom. There was a small vent that allowed the freezing early morning air of the southern countryside to rush in. It was icy inside. Jackie hurried over to the toilet, sliding the door closed and locking it quickly behind her. She peed. Next, she pulled out the rest of the toilet paper on the spool and heaped it onto the toilet. Next to the tiny sink was a paper towel dispenser. She plucked out all of them and threw them onto the toilet as well, except for one which she tucked into the pocket of her jeans. She looked into the mirror at her papery skin and black eye bags. She washed and dried her hands. She stepped out of the toilet and looked quickly in both directions up the corridors. There was no one in sight. She closed the toilet door nearly as far as she could, took out the deodorant and squeezed one hand back into the toilet and started spraying. It took nearly 3 minutes to empty the aerosol can completely. When she was done, she threw the can into the toilet as well. From the front pocket of her jeans, she pulled out a cigarette lighter and lit the end of the remaining paper towel. She flicked it through the crack and slammed the door shut. She walked back through the automatic doors and resumed her seat next to Peter. He turned to her and, with trepidation in his voice, asked, "What do you mean it's time? Time for what?" He barely got the words out when a painfully loud beeping tore through the train carriage. Almost immediately, the train began to slow. A loud pop sounded from the bathroom and the train carriage's lights went out. A guard rushed up the aisle carrying a fire extinguisher, followed by a man from the bar carriage with a vest and a delicately sculpted peak of grey hair in the centre of his head. The two train attendants rushed into the vestibule and closed the door behind them, but the closed door could not quite entirely muffle the roar as the bathroom door slid open, nor the scream as the flames leapt out and scorched the vested man's face and shirt. There was a commotion from the vestibule. Peter and Jackie heard the crackle of a walkie-talkie. She placed a hand on his thigh. Suddenly, the train driver slammed on the brakes. All around the carriage, sleeping passengers awoke and looked around in dopey consternation. The dad from the family stood up.
"Do something, Jerry,"
his wife hissed. His face was as blank and confused as a hibernating animal's. The gaming teens muttered in unwilling interest. The woman with the scarf on her head removed the scarf, and the red-headed man whooped in delight.
"What can be happening out there?"
he asked loudly, then swung around the seat and made a show of skipping up the aisle to see. Jackie dug her fingers tightly into Peter's leg, and as the red-headed man pushed open the vestibule door, she hissed,
"Now!"
He reached for his last valise.
"Leave it,"
she hissed, but he picked it up anyway. She surged forward through the carriage, and as she came to the four-seat booth where the red-headed man and his companion sat, she looked for the sports bag. It was still there. She ignored the suited man, who'd slumped down in his seat in terror, and as she reached for it, a feral laughing rang out from the far end of the carriage. The red-headed man. As Jackie turned around, he pulled the knife theatrically from behind his back and wiggled the blade at her. The children on the train screamed.
"You got me!"
he sang, holding the note on me. He began to stalk up the aisle. One of the teens rose into his path. He was a big, strong-looking boy in a rugby jersey, and just as he opened his mouth to begin to try to restore order to the situation, he noticed the knife in the man's hand, and instead his mouth made a round O. The red-headed man shoved him hard and he fell to the ground. Jackie grabbed the sports bag in one hand and pulled Peter with the other and rushed through the vestibule door, which slid loosely on its track now the carriage's power was off. Behind them there were more screams. The boy's friends had noticed the spreading pool of blood underneath him from where the red-headed man had slipped the pointy knife between his ribs. Jackie slammed the sliding door behind them.
"Hold it shut!"
Jackie gritted at Peter. The red-headed man had stepped over the teen's body now, and he continued up the carriage towards the vestibule where Peter and Jackie waited. Four doors led out of the vestibule, one to the carriage, one locked, which led to the empty guard's chamber, and two to outside, shut tight by the train's locking system. As the redhead advanced, the black-suited man with whom he'd been travelling also stood. He saw the knife and the teen in the pool of blood and began to wail,
"Oh no, oh no, oh no, 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 no."
The red-headed man grabbed him by the ears and pressed their foreheads together.
"Don't do this, Justin,"
he rasped.
get it together, Justin. Justin, come back to me.
The suited man continued to wail. The redhead straightened up, a disappointed look on his face.
This is no use to me, Justin, he sighed.
He seemed to wait a few more seconds, and as Justin's distress increased instead of diminishing, he grabbed a handful of Justin's hair at the back and dragged him forward through the carriage. As they reached the door through which Peter and Jackie were trying to find a way to escape, he pulled Justin's head back and smashed it into the window. Justin screamed. A blot of blood coloured the glass. The redhead repeated the movement, and this time the glass broke and Justin crumpled to the ground. Peter, horrified, loosened his grip, and Jackie screamed at him again to hold the door. He grabbed the handle and pushed it as hard as he could towards the door jamb. The red-headed man leant down and grinned at Peter through the hole he'd made with Justin.
What's the deal here? He asked conversationally. This is a lot. What's your endgame?
He carefully poked the blade of the long knife through the hole and tried, almost playfully, to jab it at Peter's hand. Peter squealed for help, and Jackie rifled frantically through the stolen sports bag and came out with a slender aluminium laptop. She zipped the bag shut again and hauled it over to the external door. She slammed the laptop's thin metal edge between the doors as hard as she could, then leant on one side with all her strength. The doors began to separate. A blast of cold air rushed in. She dropped the computer and began to pull on the doors, and slowly they came apart. The train had slowed now, but still clipped through the countryside at 40 k's an hour. On the other side of the door, the red-headed man sighed and raised the knife in his hand again and brought it down on the glass. A small spiderweb of cracks radiated out from the point where the handlebar had made contact. Peter yelped, and Jackie pushed hard one last time, and the doors sprang open. Outside, the countryside rushed by. There were rocks and grass by the tracks, then fields, and off in the distance a thicket of trees.
We have to jump!
Jackie shouted, and suddenly she was gone. Peter moaned in frustration. He was caught in between a bloodthirsty psychopath who was actively trying to stab his way through a glass door so he could kill Peter for reasons on which he was still very, very uncertain, and an empty doorway which led to nothing but hard ground and inconvenience. The redhead wound up for another good stab at the glass, and Peter thought, oh well, what the hell, and he launched himself blindly out of the train. The red-headed man's knife finally penetrated the glass, and his hand continued after it. The broken glass speared his hand and wrist as they followed the knife through, and blood sprayed over the vestibule. Outside the train, Peter sailed dizzily through the freezing early morning air, hit a soft bank of long grass and stopped. He'd braced himself into a fetal ball, his forearms curled around his head and his knees tucked up, and he held the position for several seconds after he landed, in anticipation of some kind of secondary, more painful impact. But the hard landing never came. Sheer luck had propelled him into a thicket of tall grass. The terrifying struggle on the train just moments ago was still in his ears and eyes, a strange contrast to the sudden silence of the grassy paddock he now stood in. A rich chuckle erupted from deep in his chest. Once again he'd launched himself at the mercy of happenstance, and once again he'd found his luck still in bountiful supply. He was a deeply superstitious man who ascribed any stroke of good luck to karmic points accrued by his own skill, charm, and big-heartedness, and bad luck to universal conspiracy. It gave him an enormous sense of well-being to know that not only was Providence still guiding his way, but also that he'd earned every scrap of positive energy it directed towards him. 200 meters back, Jackie was still on the ground where she'd landed, with one arm through the red-headed man's thick sports bag, and the other arm in a painful embrace with a barbed wire fence. In the city, it was now the morning of the fourth day after Peter Quinnell Live had killed the old man and fled, leaving his hard-working colleagues to pick up the pieces around him. The fallout was enormous and agonizing. Scandals of this magnitude were unbecoming of a media organization, and particularly of those who traded in scandals of precisely this nature. Death, betrayal, emotional interviews with traumatized bystanders. In the Five News office, loose vertical blinds flapped in a breeze of uncertain origin. No windows were open, but lonely drafts seemed to manifest from the upended waste paper baskets and loosely swinging office chairs. Judith Senyol had locked herself in her office until she felt the four walls could contain her rage no longer. As that moment arrived, she punched the intercom with a trembling finger and called Perry Algiers into her office and told him to fire Amelia, the office manager, who'd had blue mouth since the day Judith first laid eyes on her and never seemed to get any better. But Amelia's blue mouth had got into her blood and she died in her sleep.
"Fire Bevan,"
she snapped, already gloating at the thought of the mailroom leader who hadn't visited her to offer his sympathy since Peter Quinnell Live had plunged the entire network into a widening gyre of fear and recrimination and gleeful headlines for rival networks cleaning out his desk. But Bevan had quit the company to make a time investment in Juicer, his media gossip subscription app. Naomi from Accounts had had an allergic reaction to a rat bite and lost her tongue to gangrene and become an advocate for the speech impaired. Kenny Gow had stepped into a stormwater drain and drowned. Janice, the autocue operator, had succumbed quietly to a genetic disease. Richard, the runner with rosacea, had run out on a track in the Royal National Park and disappeared forever. Steve, Sophie and Aaron had been snuffed out when a van T-boned the cab they were riding in. Brett, the sports reporter, had asphyxiated after turning around in his sleeping bag. Tara, the hot intern, was brain dead after salmonella poisoning. Crosby, the political editor, had gone down in a hot air balloon crash in Lake Burley Griffin while doing a colour piece about the history of Parliament House, taking Jessica the weatherwoman, with whom he was having an affair, and the entire Canberra bureau staff who'd excitedly crammed into the basket for the free ride.
"Fire Hansie the doorman then,"
Judith demanded, and Perry told her that Hansie had moved to the Central Coast to join a cult. Jamie from HR was in a coma. Janelle from HR was also in a coma, and Brent from HR had just awoken from a coma but was so traumatised by the dreams he'd had while he was comatose that he was on indefinite personal leave.
"Fire him anyway,"
Judith snapped, but Perry told her that Brent was on a 6-month Wi-Fi detox retreat and completely uncontactable, and while they could earmark him for redundancy in the system, he wouldn't know he'd been fired, so perhaps the punitive effect Judith was aiming for was lost.
"Fire him anyway,"
Judith snapped again. But Perry reminded her that Sandra, Keenan, and Sam from HR were also absent for reasons of resignation, death, and she's the chairman's daughter and it's his 60th birthday celebration month, respectively.
"And that's everyone from HR," Perry told her.
"So I can't fire anybody?"
Judith shrieked incredulously.
Well, it depends if you mean you can't fire anybody because no one from HR is here and they need to do it, or if you mean you can't fire anyone because no one works here anymore."
Perry winced reflexively. Judith looked at him suspiciously.
"What do you mean?"
Well,
Perry stammered,
"if you mean you can't fire anyone because no one from HR is here, that's true. But if you mean you can't fire anyone because no one works here anymore, that's also true. Everyone left."
"How?"
Judith asked incredulously.
"When? Everybody?"
"Half the newsroom quit because they got jobs working for Jason Strasbourg, and a quarter quit because they expected to get jobs working for Strasbourg and jumped the gun. The chairman fired all the sub-editors because there were too many of them to sub-edit a quarter of the stories normally being filed, and it was a waste of money. The remaining quarter quit because they were embarrassed about their sloppy reporting once the subs were fired, and the cameramen are in police custody awaiting charges because they looted the newsroom and sold everything once all the reporters were gone. The mailroom have a lottery syndicate and won $18 million each. Sales was outsourced in Q3 last year, and most of accounting got food poisoning on a business lunch and are awaiting a substantial payout from the restaurant owner, which means that the only staff left here are the chairman, his daughter Sam, you, and me, and you can't fire the chairman or his daughter."
Judith narrowed her eyes.
"I see," she said.
Her lips spasmed in rich glee.
"Well, Perry," she indulged herself, "it seems I've got no choice but to let you..."
But before she could get any further, the phone rang. It was the chairman's daughter.
"Get up here, Judith,"
she snapped. Judith and Perry froze. Judith stared into Perry's eyes and found understanding. Only one of them would survive.
"Well, Perry," she spat,
I doubt His Excellency's going to cut me loose, but if on the off chance he fires me before I can come back here and fire you, know that you'll never be able to walk down another street in your fucking life without looking over your shoulder to see if someone's about to peg a rock at your hideous bald head. You disgust me, you fucking pig. I hope you die.
Judith scurried through the corridors and into the chairman's office and sagged down into one of the several mid-century armchairs strewn about the room.
"What's this about?" she demanded.
"Ah," the chairman squeaked. "Judith, how nice to be visited in person."
She waved a hand irritably.
"It's about Peter Quinnell Live," the chairman explained.
Judith rolled her eyes and lit a cigarette. She didn't smoke, except to convey disrespect.
"Judith, please,"
the chairman moped. She took no notice.
"It's like this. The board just sent off a cheque for $65 million to get Peter's likeness in every railway station in the country. It'll be a cutout, life-size, and he'll be holding a TV, which will be real, and the TV will be playing his show. It's a great campaign. It can't miss. But we need him. If we don't have him, we pulp the cutouts. The TVs are built into them, so we'll have to pulp the TVs too."
Judith spat irritably on the rug.
"I need him too, the little fuck," she barked. "You make him come back."
"It's not just getting him to come back," the chairman said nervously. "We need him to come back full strength, no clouds hanging over him. And you're his boss."
Slowly it dawned on Judith what she was being asked.
"You want me to rehabilitate him?"
she asked incredulously.
"Of course," the chairman beamed.
Judith crossed her arms and glared.
"Not possible even if I wanted to."
"Oh, I'm sure it's possible," the chairman peeped happily. "You'll make it work."
Judith stood up in a cold rage.
"Not happening. Never happening," she snapped.
The chairman sighed.
"Don't be like that, Judith," he complained. "It's a complicated situation. The only alternative is to have him taken care of."
She spun around.
"You'd do that?"
she asked suspiciously. The chairman shrugged.
"Sure, if there were no other options."
She smiled maliciously.
"Do it then,"
she snarled. And the door behind her opened. Two heavy-set police officers entered. Judith whipped back around.
"Oh, Judith," the chairman sighed. "You shouldn't have said that. You're not giving these officers much of a choice."
Judith gritted her teeth.
"What do you mean?" she spat. "If you instruct me to kill Peter Quinnell live, you're breaking your bail conditions, which specifically forbid you from ordering any hits. All you have to do is not instruct me to do that and agree to my request, and the officers will leave the room again."
"What about you?"
Judith shrieked.
"You're the one who offered to have him killed in the first place."
The chairman beamed.
"I think you'll find I said we could have him taken care of."
"That's all I agreed to,"
she shouted.
"I never said I wanted him killed. I only agreed with you."
The chairman's grin grew wider.
"It's contextual," he purred. "Only one of us is out on bail for trying to have Peter Quinnell live killed. A sentence which, for me, is innocuous, is much more sinister when it comes from you."
He extended a hand and gestured at the chair.
"Please, Judith, be reasonable. Sit down and do what I ask, and these officers will have no cause to remand you."
Judith's knees weakened and she slumped into the chair.
"I wouldn't even know how to rehabilitate him," she moped.
The chairman leaned over the desk and patted her knee.
"There, there," he said. "We'll come up with something."
"Ah!"
He clicked his fingers.
"Matter of fact, how's this? You can just say you did it."
Judith looked blankly at him.
"Did what?"
The chairman chuckled.
"Killed the old man, of course."
"We can say you did it. Fantastic. It'd be manslaughter, not murder, you see. Intent is everything. I know some marvellous lawyers who'd even be able to get the whole contract killing accident written off as a byproduct of stress. Completely understandable. Jerry, do you think you could handle that?"
A voice crackled out of the phone on the chairman's desk.
"Yeah, piece of cake."
Judith stared with mounting horror at the phone, at the chairman, at the police officers, at the phone again.
You want to say I did it?"
she said weakly. The chairman beamed.
"That's it.
So Peter Quinnell Live can have his job back."
"Oh, more or less."
"What's in it for me?" Judith demanded.
The chairman frowned.
"Well, we have you on tape threatening to have him killed, so if you don't agree, you're going to jail anyway."
Judith stared at him incredulously.
"So in either scenario, I walk out of here with those cops, But you want me to choose the option that also exonerates Peter Quinnell live?
That's right, the chairman beamed. Why the fuck would I do that? She spat.
Oh well, he said, picking up a newspaper. If you don't, we'll just say you did it anyway, and you'll go down for both. But it's up to you.
She paused for a long moment. At last, she spoke again. Fine.
The chairman didn't even look at her as he swung his chair around, and the police officers escorted Judith away.
Thanks for listening to The Horse and the Rider. It's written, read and produced by me, Max Laverne. If you'd like to support it, you can make a donation at ko-fi.com/Max Laverne. And I love it when I get messages about the podcast. You can DM me on Twitter, prawn_meat. Please hit me up. If you know anyone who's into holes, make sure you tell them about this podcast, because next week in episode 12, a critical hole is dug. So it's a great time to go the whole hog, as they might say.